Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. On the show today, we'll be getting to grips with some of this month's fiction and non-fiction releases with the writers and book critics Kathy Rensenbrink and Mark Mason, who will join me here in the studio. Plus, we'll head out to find out the latest TV trends at the MIP TV conference in Cannes. We'll discuss the art of storytelling in Toronto, and we'll be donning our thermals, oh yes, as we jump on board a ship to take us south to the Antarctic Biennale. Plus, later on the programme, I'll be joined by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who'll be running us through the top five songs that Nigeria's been listening to this week. That is all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Kathy and Mark, welcome to the show. Good
Hello.
To have you back
Thank
with
you
us.
Much.
We'll be alternating between fiction and non-fiction today. Let's begin with one of Kathy's novels, Larchfield, by the writer and poet Polly Clark. In this we meet another poet, W.H. Auden, who in 1930 was a master at the Scottish school, Larchfield. Clark tells his story alongside a fictional character, Dora Fielding, yet another poet suffering from postnatal depression who's just moved to the area. Kathy, I'm always interested in that sort of device. How do these two stories work alongside each other? Is it about complement? Is it about jarring? What's the idea here?
Yeah, it works very well. I think one of the pitfalls of the two strand novel is if you start enjoying one strand a lot more than the other one. So you're sort of merrily reading along about Bob, but really you want to get back to Graham. There is none of that here, I can assure you. It's extremely nicely woven together. And there's all sorts of very subtle little mirrorings and shadowings between the two characters. I found it a very enjoyable read. I don't know much about Auden, so that it was nice to sort of find that out. And the way that the poet's creativity, feeling like an outsider, that's one of the things that the two characters really have in common, because Auden's sort of been shoved in this school where he's unhappy, he's got to earn some money, his first poetry collection's about to come out, and Dora has been uprooted to go and be with her husband, she has a premature baby. I really like the contrasts between the world of the 30s with all its various restrictions, especially for Auden as a gay man, and then the world of the, pretty much the world of the now, you know, with mean nurses who are nasty to her about breastfeeding on demand. So it was a really nice, really clever, I thought, the way that it covers an awful lot of range, but in a way that feels very accomplished with debut.
Well, speaking of accomplished achievements, it's interesting. It's a story, it's written by a poet, it's about a poet, well, a real-life poet, and also about a fictional poet. So one would imagine that it's a fairly, I don't know, is it quite sort of lyrical in its tone in the delivery?
Well, this probably sounds like an odd recommendation, but I would say don't let the poetry pit put you off. I'm often a little bit wary when poets write novels. I don't really like to read novels stuffed full of poetic language, and this isn't that at all. I mean, it's beautifully written, but yeah, I mean it as a compliment that you wouldn't know she's a poet.
I've always thought if you were doing poetry, it's such a discipline. Obviously, it can be if you're trying to do every line rhyming with it, or, you know, conventional poetry, but even less formulaic poetry, there's still discipline there. It's got to be poetry rather than prose. I would strike me that would be an absolute joy to go and I think, right, I can just write a normal sentence now if I want.
I'm not sure about that, but definitely I feel she wanted to tell a story. And I think one of the things with poetry is that it is more about language than about story. And I think novels, loads of people disagree with me about this, by the way, so don't scream at me if you're listening.
That's
novels,
like,
I feel,
like all
are
different opinions.
Novels should foreground the story rather than the form. And I think with poetry, it tends to be the other way around. So I can completely see why. But then, of course, I'm not a poet. So, of course, I think, oh, imagine the joy of being able to write a novel rather than a
And
poet.
Did you trust everything she was saying about Auden? Because I'm always suspicious if a real person is in a fictional story. Are they going to crowbar in real stuff? Or are they going to invent stuff about him that isn't necessarily grounded in fact? It can go either
way. I wished
way.
I'd known a bit more of him. Yeah. I intuit that all that's very well done as well. And again, but with a very light hand. Because I think the pitfall with real people is often writers just slightly can't resist regurgitating their research onto the page. And that's what it feels like. Mm. Whereas in this, there are a few times where you think, well, that sounds like it's probably true. And I wonder where she found that out from. But it's real, with a real light hand. It made me want to go off and find out more about Auden, as in it would lead me on to going to reread things. And of course, Isherwood gets mentioned, so I sort of, and there's a trip to Berlin. I really wanted to go off and reread Goodbye to Berlin.
It hasn't got the Alan Bennett quote about Auden in, has it? No. You know that one? Alan Bennett is so good. They've shown, you know, famously, Alden's face is completely jowled, you know, lined and craggy, and looks like you could lose 10p coins in the crags in his face. And Alan Bennett looked at a photo of him and said, oh my God, if that's what his face is like, imagine what his scrotum must look like.
Well, that takes a prize early for things that I didn't think were going to crop up on this edition of the Monocle Archery.
But I don't remember the mention of the scrotum, I must say.
Okay, it's a scrotum-free zone, largely. But I think it struck me as interesting what you said about that lightness of touch, because obviously the book, I suppose, also, you know, we're looking at some quite vulnerable people, maybe a little unstable at times, and that can be quite hard work in less skilled hands. Do you think that Clark is able to inject some humour and levity, that deafness that you described, does it sort of lighten the tone of the piece? Because it could be more challenging, potentially, because of the subject matter.
Yeah, it could. It's not a miserable book to read, though you're right. It does pass over some fairly difficult territory. I mean, the bit I found hardest was, of course, Auden is a school teacher at this pretty grim boarding school with young boys, and some of the things that happening to them aren't very nice, and that's sort of suggested more than is obvious. But that's the bit I found, again, that's being the mother of a 7-year-old boy, I think. I've become so sensitive about anything about little boys. So that was the bit I actually found hardest to read, whereas I've just loved all the new mother, you know, the new mother struggling with the reality of being a new mother, and then the way, as the reader, you don't quite know what's happening to her reality, and is she telling us the true story of how these people are around her, or is she overreacting to them, and all that sort of stuff. I just thought was brilliantly done. But again, if it was only the one story strand, it possibly would be a bit claustrophobic, whereas because you've got the two stories going on, you keep going from one to the other, and again sort of stepping into more space, I suppose.
A success, it seems. A Larchfield by Polly Clark is out now. It's published by River Run. Mark, let's turn to you next for the first of our non-fiction picks of the day. Science writer Marcus Chown's new book, The Ascent of Gravity: The Quest to Understand the Force That Explains Everything, snappy, attempts to tell the history of gravity from its discovery as a force by Sir Isaac Newton in the 17th century and how our understanding of it has developed ever since. Well, I guess that's a good starting point, is motivation. Marcus Chown is pretty well known. He tackles some of these very big issues. What do you think the impetus was for this particular history that he's tackled?
Well, I guess he just wanted to do what it says on the tin, as you say, you know, the snappy subtitle. It, of course, as with all these science books, it ties together other things as well. Like a huge part of the second part of the book, he goes on to Einstein's work on gravity, is the theory of relativity, and that. I've still not got that sorted in my head. Literally,
I think you may be in good company. Yeah. speaking only for myself.
Well,
Cathy,
he does.
I don't know about you.
Chown does quote Eddington, who was the British scientist who, not long after Einstein had come up with the theory, someone said to Arthur Eddington, is it true that there are only three people in the world who understand the theory of relativity? And Eddington said, who's the third? Because he'd got it, and he knew Einstein hadn't. I still haven't entirely got it. And this is one of those books, and I mean this in the best possible sense, because I loved the book, is that I want to go back and reread certainly the second half again and again and again. And I think if I were to read it 10 times, by the end of the 10th, I would be pretty well there. Because it's certainly got me much further with Einstein's work than a lot of previous books have. But just to go back to the first half for a second, it's brilliant. Most of the first half of the book is about Newton and his work on gravity. And it's one of those books that answers the questions that you sort of, it's all around us, the stuff he's talking about, but you never really ask the questions yourself. Is how we all know it's from a childhood, you know, we're taught this, and we sort of know it in theory, in general, that the moon causes the tides and the moon's gravity causes the tides. But how? And Marcus Chown just explains it brilliantly. It's the first person I've ever seen in literally two or three paragraphs, pulls it together in that all objects exert a gravitational pull. There is a gravitational pull between you and me, between your head and your big toe, between a pen on the desk and the paperclip next to it. But only once you get up to planet-sized objects does it become a noticeable force. So obviously the moon is going around the Earth because of gravity, but also the moon is exerting a gravitational pull on the Earth, much smaller because it's a smaller body, but still enough to cause the tides. Because as the moon goes over any particular point in the ocean, the moon passes over it once in 24 hours and pulls the surface of the water towards it more than it pulls the water at the bottom of the ocean towards it, because that water's further away. So the surface of the water bulges upwards, and that's what causes the tide. But then also at the same time, the moon's gravitational force is going all the way through the Earth. So the point directly opposite that point in the ocean is also being pulled towards the moon. And in this case, because it's on the other side, the water at the bottom of the ocean there is being pulled upwards more, it's been pulled towards the moon, rather, more than the water on the surface of the earth. So that's what causes the tide there, you see. And that's why you get two tides in a day. And it's beautiful. He explains it in simple language. He's one of those science writers, and I've read a couple of, or tried to read, a couple of American science books recently. And American writers, are, by and large, I think, are nowhere near as good at this. Marcus Chan can just put himself in the position of being able to remember what he was like before he knew this stuff, i.e. the position we're in now as the reader.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you about, accessibility and the effectiveness of communicating some very complex ideas to essentially a lay reader. And, well, I think you've addressed that very, very eloquently. And that wasn't that easy to paraphrase even what he had said to us.
I almost thought I understood it at the time.
I'm going to pass that off as knowledge that I have accrued through reading much more complicated books. Do you think, it intrigues me, is there a tiered system then for science writers? Because I wonder whether some people would say, oh, well, you know, that Marcus Chan, you know, he writes for the layman. Where's the challenge in that? But in a way, it's probably more difficult than writing a very highfalutin academic text on.
He remembers that in the end, we're all laymen.
You know, I think in science writing, actually, everybody accepts that that's the aim, to say it's something difficult and make it easy to understand. Whereas actually, I think in literature, people are always trying to take things that are quite easy and make them much more difficult to understand. And the idea that you might want to do something other than that is a bit peculiar.
Yeah. I've heard lots of people over the years try and explain why they predicted the existence of Neptune before we'd seen it in the night sky. Mm. Basically, the reason they knew it must be there is because Uranus, the planet that's near it, was behaving in a strange way. Its motion was not going, as we observed it in the night sky, was not happening in the way we expected it to. And that's because Neptune was exerting its gravitational pull on Uranus. And so they started, look, they predicted this. How good are they to do this? Centuries past, before computers existed, to do the maths for them.
It's truly mind-bending stuff. Just very briefly, because we're going to move on. But are we on the brink of a gravitational revolution? I don't want to issue any spoilers to readers.
Happening? Tom, I'm in no danger of spoiling it, because this is one of the things in the last couple of chapters that I need to go back and reread another 10 times. But yes, we are, is the short answer.
Well, we'll bring our listeners an update on that. And if it's going to be critical for the planet, we'll let them know. The Ascent of Gravity, The Quest to Understand the Force That Explains Everything by Marcus Chan is out now, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Now, before we find out Cathy and Mark's second choices, we're going to pop over to Toronto for another literary-themed event. Founded in the late 1970s, the Toronto Storytelling Festival has become one of the largest annual gatherings of storytellers on the planet. This year's event drew to a close this past weekend and hosted storytellers from around the world who mused on the theme for this year's gathering, which was listening. Monocle's team at our Toronto Bureau went to meet some of those involved in this year's festival to ask them about the health of storytelling today.
My name is Dan Yashinsky. I'm the director of the 2017 Toronto Storytelling Festival, which is put on by Storytelling Toronto. Well, the first thing I want to say about storytelling as an art, and it's related to the theme of this year's festival, is that I think, to me, storytelling is a subversive art form. It is a subversive thing in our society to remind people that they carry their own stories, that no one can take away the stories that you hold within yourself. We use the term word of mouth, but really it's word of heart. And those are the stories that people have always communicated orally. So that's what the festival's about, is oral storytelling. And so we have people coming up. A biologist is talking about her work with whales and elephants. A sculptor is coming up to talk about installations he does to commemorate extinct bird species. Try to imagine what song did they carry. Native storytellers coming up to talk about how their story traditions have never been lost. I mean, they might have been eroded, but they're fighting very hard to sustain them.
But anyways, I'm walking to school, that crunch, 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 crunch of celery beneath my feet, and I hear a, hey, you're late.
My name is Marcia Shandor, and I am a storytelling teacher, and also I am the host and founder of True Stories Told Live Toronto. True Story Soul Life Toronto has been running for 4 years. It's 5 storytellers, all telling true stories, live without notes, and one of them is a musician who either includes music in their story or tells a story about the song and then plays the song. Having the Toronto Storytelling Festival is a great way to kind of bring live storytelling into the consciousness of people in Toronto, because there's a lot of it going on, but it often happens in tiny little pockets. And storytelling is a thing that we have been doing since the dawn of time. It's how we passed information down before we had, you know, not even just the internet, before we had books. It's how we passed information down. It's how we calmed each other down around the campfires. And so storytelling is like deeply woven into our culture. It's also deeply woven into our bodies. When you tell a story, the person listening's brain acts as if they are inside the story. You talk about smelling coffee, their olfactory cortex lights up. You talk about grabbing a pen, their motor cortex lights up. And so it really bonds you to people and it connects you to them. And as humans, we're wired to connect. We need it to stay alive. So by listening to and telling stories, we're keeping each other alive. And that's why the Toronto Storytelling Festival is so important, because we've got to keep people alive.
There's an old Jewish proverb that says, the more stories you know, the more ways you have of telling the truth. Actually, I made that up, but I'm an old Jew, so it counts as an old Jewish proverb. But I really believe that's true, that the language of story, it kind of immunizes you against certain kinds of bullshit and certain kinds of lies.
It wasn't like that. It looked like a bike shop. I was like, actually, like, it wasn't like actually like afraid. It was like concerned. Like, did they misunderstand the surgery I'm supposed to have? I don't have a flat tire.
My name is Saren Keister. I've been volunteering with a number of storytelling events in the city of Toronto for about 2.5 years now. I've referred to storytelling as sort of a version of live discount therapy, in the sense that you take something that, an experience that nobody else has ever had, because it was yours. Even if somebody else went through something similar, they've never had your experience. And by offering it up to an audience, there's an exchange that happens. You are taking something from inside of you and putting it out, and you can learn from it by being able to look at it in your hand instead of it being inside your heart. And there's also a sense of like letting it go. And a lot of the inspiration, not always, but a lot of the inspiration for a lot of storytellers is something very impactful. Maybe it was something painful, maybe it was something beautiful. But it was this really important moment, and there's something to be said for saying it out loud. And I think a lot of people understand that. So I find it a very entertaining medium. I think it's a very fun thing to do. I think it's very interesting to learn these experiences. But more than that, I would say it's incredibly important for a sense of community, for a sense of connection. To do this, it's a practice that I think is just innate part of being human. I not only enjoy it, I think it's actively something that should be encouraged. I think it's important as a human being to tell your story.
I think Toronto has been a very good habitat for storytelling, and I've often wondered why. And I suppose one reason is that we're from so many places. And of course, when you come from elsewhere, it doesn't matter how many bags of luggage you have with you. The fact of the matter is you brought your stories. So I think it has been a congenial city for the art of storytelling, as witnessed by the fact this festival has been around a long time. There are many storytelling gatherings you can go to any night of the week. There's people telling true stories and folk tales and every kind of story.
Thanks to Thomas Lewis and Ian Keddie in Toronto for that report from the Toronto Storytelling Festival. You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. I'm joined today by the writers and book critics Mark Mason and Kathy Rensenbrink. Kathy, let's turn back to you now for your second choice of fiction this week, a book called White Tears by Harry Kunzru. What made you pick this one?
Well, I mean, this is the best novel I've read in ages, I think. I thought it was spectacular. And a massive page turner, which I must say I loved, like right from the beginning. I was just in the world and didn't want to do anything else and just wanted to read this brilliant book. And I do like it when a book takes me that way and it makes it very easy to not do anything else and reminds me of, you know, how novels can work when they're so immersive that all you want to do is carry on reading them.
Certainly, again, more high praise. I've sort of scanned around for some broad brush descriptions of the book. And it's a ghost story, it's a murder mystery, a meditation on race, a love letter to forgotten geniuses of American music, Delta Mississippi Blues. It sounds like a lot to pack in. How would you sum it up?
Well, I tell you what it reminded me of a little bit was actually books like The Secret History by Donna Tartt. And I like books where you've got an outsider narrator. So Seth is a kind of a bit of a non-entity, a bit of a nerd. He records people. You know, that's his thing. He likes recording people. And because of that, he accidentally meets at college someone called Carter. And Carter is extremely rich. sort of rich beyond the wildest dreams of all of us, trust fund rich. And then they set up this studio together in New York. And Seth has basically nothing other than his ability to record things and this friendship with Carter. And then they start to think they have, in a sort of slightly eerie way, they discover this blues song. And they release it and it goes viral and people get in touch with them. Another one of my things is I never really care that much whether or not I fully understand something. So I don't...
This seems to be a little bit of a theme, I guess, that's running through today. Yeah.
It'd be boring if you always understood everything.
Yeah.
The only reason for coming on living is you might learn something new.
Well, I think the whole thing about is it a ghost story, is it supernatural, is it a terror? It almost feels like horror at some point, but I kind of don't really care. And I also don't really care at which points. I don't need to know. A bit like in the previous book, actually. I don't need to know with either of the characters whether they're actually mad or whether they're being visited by some spirit. To me as a reader, I don't need to know which one of those things is true, and I quite like it if I don't really know. So the story sort of carries on. It's about cultural appropriation, but mainly you just feel so completely lost in it as a story. And again, that's something I always admire from writers, when they can do that to you. And even if kind of part of your brain starts slightly going like, hang on a minute, they're just so good at spinning the words that the other part of your brain is saying, no, don't bring any cynicism into this. I just want to carry on reading.
And it does sound like there's some interesting sort of motifs that run through this. We've got, I guess, the nature of authenticity, I guess, in a way, is a bit of a theme, whether that's around race, I mentioned briefly, or music and music copyright, this sort of thing. Are the characters interested in the authentic in the book, or is authenticity something that's at the heart of it?
Well, yes, it is. And authenticity being stolen by other people for their own purposes, and what authenticity is. Another thing I thought was quite impressive about it is it blew up my own little theory. I don't think books about music work in the way that, bear with me, the books where you've got fictional artwork really work. Another book this slightly reminded me of is What I Loved by Siri Hustvedt, which is one of my favourite novels. So again, a book with serious artwork and you feel the artwork is real. So I think books about fictional artwork, books about fictional books, books about fictional poetry, they all work. But I've never before read a book about fictional music that I think works. I've never really understood why that is, whereas this one somehow completely does. I always wondered whether it's because you have the lyric of this blues song, and of course on the page, I mean, you have the words, you don't know what it sounds like, but somehow that doesn't matter. Also, I don't really know anything about music, so I never knew at any point whether all the various references spinning around, I presume quite a lot of them are real, which I think, again, if you did know about music, I think this would probably open up another whole dimension, probably in a good way, or maybe you'd say he doesn't know what he's on about, I don't know. But I don't know anything about music and enjoyed all that sound of it. I also didn't understand any of the technical stuff about recording. There's loads about vinyl, there's loads of history about at what point different formats of records, I'm sure I'm saying this all wrong, happened. And all of that's kind of quite enjoyable as well. And then just this sort of the machinations of power and privilege and how that works and who always triumphs and who always gets fucked over again and again and again and again. And I think that's what this book does really well.
And I guess given what's going on in contemporary America at the moment, that feels as relevant.
I think it's very relevant. Yeah, certainly as a reader at the moment, I feel I really do want to read books about race in America. And there's been, because The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead and Homegoing by Yar Gyasi, which were both directly about slavery, and this isn't, but you do get a bit of a walk through sort of segregation era, the South, which is extremely sobering, as of course it would be. So I certainly feel as a reader I've an appetite for these sorts of books, and obviously I think everyone should have an appetite for these sorts of books.
Indeed. Well, White Tears by Harry Kunzer is out now. Finally, Mark, let's come back to you. We have writer, sailor, soldier, spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures 1935-61 by Nicholas Reynolds, evidence that the great writer, I don't know, dabbled in espionage. It sounds intriguing. Is that, I don't know, am I giving it the right sell?
You are. It doesn't deliver on that sell in the terms you've just painted. And that's what I was expecting and hoping for. There would be lots of espionage. Hemingway as James Bond. Hemingway as a, you know, some sort of...
In so many ways, he could have been that character.
And in the end, he doesn't... basically, to fill you in on the basics of the plot, if this was one of Hemingway's novels, is that he's in Spain during the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, helping to fight against Franco And he sort of helps blow up a train there. That's one of the few things he does actually do. And then he sort of agrees to spy for the Soviets in China, leading up to the Second World War. But he doesn't even meet it. They give him the name Argo, the code name Argo, because they didn't just pick code names at random. They tied them to the agent. And he was famous for his love of sailing. And so Argo was Jason and the Argonaut ship. So that's their name for Hemingway. But he doesn't actually meet up with the NKVD, the Soviet spying agency, with the operatives in China. Then during the Second World War, he's sailing around the Mediterranean, sorry, around the Caribbean, looking out for German U-boats. And he gets his contact in the American government to say, could you get some grenades to, so that when we pull up in my fishing boat behind this, any German U-boat we find, we can lob some grenades down the tower of the U-boat and blow it up. And he never actually spots a U-boat. And then toward the final bit of the book is about Cuba, where he's living. And Castro is engaging in his revolution. And Hemingway wants to help out Castro. Basically, all the way through the book, he's anti-fascist. He's very clear all the way through. He's not communist, which is one of the reasons he doesn't get called between the House Un-American Activities Committee during the McCarthy hearings, which is a pity, because he promised that if he had been called before them, he would have looked them. He said, I think his phrase was, very slowly and carefully into the microphone, he would have, and this would have been on TV, and he would have looked at the committee members and said that they appear to me to be cocksuckers, which I really wanted him to be called just for that moment.
That might have wrong-footed them just for a moment
well,
or two.
Then he'd have ended up in prison, yeah. And in the end, he never really does that much. It's all talk, but, and this is a big but, it's a great book in the end, because it gives you lots of the details of what he's up to and what's happening. And when he's in Cuba, he's looking out for any people that might possibly be fascists. This is during World War II, and he sets up what he calls the Crook Factory, capital C, capital F. And this has been given sort of, you know, official imprimatur of the government. I don't know whether they're just humouring him, but they said, yeah, go away and do that for us, Ernest. And they're described as, these aren't Hemingway's words, but they're described by someone who knows what's going on, as a bizarre combination of bartenders, wharf rats, Danahill pilota players and former bullfighters, Basque priests, assorted exiled counts and dukes. So it's obviously a bit of fantasizing going on, and, you know, they're not achieving an awful lot, but it does make for a good read when you're going through encountering people like this.
I was going to say, I mean, Hemingway was, I don't know if paranoid is the right word, but there's suggestions again, like later in his life, there was some paranoia that he himself was being surveilled and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And this was a time of paranoia, particularly in the United States. Yeah. Is that sense of this constant nervousness, this constant looking over one's shoulder?
And on two levels, yeah. God, I hate to sound like a critic that says on two levels, because it always reminds me of that Fry and Laurie sketch. You remember of the steam before I go, I think this novel worked on 17 levels. And you know, goes, oh, really? I spotted 19. But there's the general paranoia, as you say, of the time. And we always need it. Now we've got ISIS. When I was growing up, it was the Soviet Union, nuclear war. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was, again, the Soviets. But, you know, any sort of red invasion, the commies and... So there's that general level, but then also at the specific level, Ernest Hemingway did end up, well, it's clear, the fact he killed himself with a shotgun, he did end up a very troubled bloke. And in fact, that's mentioned a bit in this book. Towards the end, the final few months of his life, they drive past a bank, which happens to have its lights on at night, 10 o'clock at night or something. And Hemingway just assumes that it's the FBI looking into his bank records and personally keeping an eye on him. And he ends up completely messed up. And I didn't know about it. There were several suicide attempts before the successful one. One of which involved him, as they were getting a plane somewhere, he and his wife, involved him trying to walk into the whirring propeller of the aeroplane just as they're about to get onto it. And that didn't succeed. But yeah, he was a very troubled soul.
Troubled souls. Well, we've sort of run the gauntlet of troubled souls, great geniuses, all sorts, and everywhere in between. That one is writer, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Ernest Hemingway's Secret Adventures, 1935-61, by Nicholas Reynolds. It's out now, published by HarperCollins. Mark and Cathy, thank you very much for your book reviews today. Great to speak with you. Now, this week, the television industry has descended upon Cannes for MIPTV. The biannual conference highlights the key formats and trends in television, streaming and online content. For the year ahead, we dialed up Broadcast Magazine's Peter White to find out what we should be looking out for.
MIP happens twice a year, happens in April and October. The October event tends to be dominated by the US, both in terms of the the broadcasters and the producers and distributors. So what it means in April, you've got a little bit more opportunity for countries that don't necessarily get a look in there. So whether that's Europeans, whether that's Latin Americans. So there tends to be a quite nice mix of different stories from different countries and slightly weird and wonderful ideas. And this year was no different.
Tell us about the best European drama that you've seen at the fair.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a real focus on drama, as no surprise. You know, we're living in a world of high-end, big-budget scripts. So, yeah, a couple of the standout things. Ride Upon the Storm was a very interesting project created by the man who created Borgen, Adam Price. It is produced for DR in Denmark, so the home of many of his own shows. But that was a very interesting show. There was also a 1920s period drama from Germany called Babylon Berlin, which was created by Run Lola Run director Tom Feiker, where a cop is sort of forced to move to Berlin to deal with the strange and slightly difficult political situation going on in the city. There was a slightly bizarre Russian sci-fi drama called Better Than Us that caught a few people's eye, and a very brutal Brazilian prison drama called Jailers, which was somewhere between sort of Oz meets Breaking Bad.
Oh, quite a good mix there. And also, it's interesting, Peter, because I guess another one of the trends of this year's MIPTV is kind of the return of the global game show. Because a lot of people said, you know, with the streaming services on, that people would not, like, you know, watch a game show on Saturday afternoon. But do you think there's a comeback?
Yeah, I do. There hasn't really been a global format, you know, a non-scripted show that's broken through since The Voice, which was launched quite a few years ago. And it was even further back to think about things like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or Deal or No Deal. We're starting to see a little bit more movement in that area. A couple of interesting titles this week. The Wall, which is actually an NBC show, which is produced by a basketball player called LeBron James. It is quite random. It's almost, if you remember Red or Black, the Anton Deck game show from a few years ago in the UK, it's not too dissimilar than that, other than, you know, there is a wall and people win money, but it's quite sort of, as I said, random. That sort of made its way to Spain and Germany, some deals struck there. There was an interesting show called Five Gold Rings, which came from Talpa, the company behind The Voice, which is a sort of general knowledge game show, but with a sort of interactive element, an interactive floor where people had to put their answers. So yeah, no, there's some certainly movement in that, and I think a lot of people, a lot of buyers are really looking for that, especially in our turbulent times. People quite like a sort of light entertainment.
Do you think game shows have a space in streaming services like Netflix, for example?
Well, the game shows do. I mean, Netflix has just launched a show called Ultimate Beastmaster, which is a sort of Ninja Warrior, Total Wipeout style show. And it's a bit more of a competition format. I'm not sure you know, it's not really a game show in the traditional sense. But yeah, they're certainly starting to look at that. Both Netflix and Amazon were down here to see if there was a show that could fit that mold for them. I think that what those streaming services are trying to do at the moment is they started off on high-end drama, you know, with the obvious House of Cards, and they are starting to move into all types of shows. You look at Amazon doing The Grand Tour, but, you know, equally there's talk of more traditional documentaries, there's talk of more traditional lighter entertainment, and I think they're just trying to become channels.
And finally, Peter, when you go to MIPTV, what do you most look forward to see? You know, the traditional dramas or perhaps like a wacky game show?
Oh, there's always something. What was it last year? I think it was celebrity pole dancing. So, you know, there's always a strange Japanese game show that you see and you don't really understand. Yeah, those are always fun, whether they travel necessarily. I tell you what, you go down there, you hope to be surprised. You're likely to see some big budget drama, and we know that. And we know there's going to be some big stars in them. But what's always fascinating to see is that idea that sort of bubbles under from somewhere you don't expect. It happened a few years ago in Israel with The Rising Star, and, you know, a show that came out of that. And there's a lot of talk about some of the Asian formats. Korea particularly was a place where people have really been looking to see if they can find an idea. They like the idea, they like the way they make stories. So yeah, no, that's what I always enjoy at MIPTV. Hopefully you come back with something that you didn't expect.
That was Peter White, international editor at Broadcast Magazine. Now, it's rather hard to find any place in the world that doesn't have a Biennale at the moment. Now, it seems even the southernmost continent in the world hasn't escaped without one either. However, the first ever Antarctic Biennale claims to have cast aside the conventional ideas of these champagne-swilling events and radically reimagined the traditional model. For a start, this Biennale is mobile, based on a boat cruising through Antarctica. It has no public audience or commercial agenda, and it's apolitical because the Antarctic content is not governed by any single state. Last month, Monocle's Frederick Bernas joined the Biennale for its inaugural 12-day expedition, and he sent this report.
Good morning, Biennale. Today is Sunday. Current conditions outside, well, we've got a bit of a rough sea.
It's 7:30 a.m. and the sun is coming up for the Antarctic Biennale. A vast research vessel, the academic Sergei Vavilov, has been taken over by a motley crew of 80 artists, scientists, and interdisciplinary thinkers.
And the water temperature is +3.
Every day, they wake up to a busy agenda focused on landings at different sites, where installations and performances take place. The founder and commissioner, Russian artist Alexander Ponomaryov, says he wants to create a new organizational system which challenges conventional wisdom.
The Antarctic Biennale is an artistic phenomenon which exists in a completely different dimension. It's an alternative to the current artistic structures. Despite the fact we're called a Biennale, it's an upside-down Biennale, built in a different way. Instead of national pavilions, there are cabins and gangways. Instead of commercial elements, it is absolutely non-commercial. Instead of exhibition halls, there is the shore, the water, and the blue Antarctic sky.
The fact that Antarctica used to be the only continent not represented at the Venice Biennale, arguably the world's most important art festival, has long intrigued Ponomaryov. In 2009, he changed that by launching the Antarctic Pavilion in Venice. Because Antarctica doesn't have a culture ministry which could officially apply to the Biennale, the pavilion was an independent initiative.
In a way, it's almost like claiming a continent when you kind of walk on land. You plant a flag and it's yours.
That's Nadim Saman, a curator of both the Pavilion and the Biennale.
And people sort of said, well, okay, so you're Antarctica. Of course, the question is, what right do you have to kind of represent Antarctica? And, but that was the kind of function of our curatorial agenda, was asking, like, how do we develop cultural questions around Antarctica that are truly based in a kind of supranational or post-national outlook?
That open approach takes after the Antarctic Treaty of 1959. It was initially signed by 12 countries who agreed to classify the area as a politically neutral territory dedicated to scientific research. Another 41 countries have signed up since. With this global spirit in mind, the Biennale invited a diverse group of artists to the expedition. They came from Angola, Argentina, France, Morocco, Japan, and the United Arab Emirates, to name a few. The installations included two robots built by Joaquin Fargas, which compress snow into ice to preserve the Antarctic environment by accelerating the formation of glaciers. German architect Gustav Dusing designed a tent made of cotton to be sprayed with water until it froze, turning harsh temperatures into a structural advantage. Brazilian video artist Alexis Anastasio projected sketches of ancient rock paintings onto a huge iceberg. And Thomas Saraceno from Argentina presented his flying aerocene sculpture, a solar-powered kite that conveys an important message about sustainable energy. Another piece with scientific resonance was Arriba by Paul Rosero Contreras, an Ecuadorian artist who has a background in biology. He shipped a cocoa plant all the way from the Amazon rainforest and installed it in a temperature-controlled container on the snow. It was a kind of tropical time capsule, taking us back 50 million years, to when Antarctica itself had a temperate climate. Contreras loves breaking down boundaries with his work, but he feels like the term interdisciplinarity, a key buzzword of the Biennale, is actually somewhat outdated.
I come from a completely multidisciplinary education, and I never even ask myself if my projects are artistic, scientific, or whatever. I'm interested in the idea of producing knowledge. I've done experiments, worked with engineers, and I consider myself an artist. I like presenting my projects in artistic mediums because art lets you do things which expand the conscience of humanity.
Contreras tackled heavy bureaucracy to bring his plant to Antarctica, where strict rules forbid the introduction of alien flora and fauna. Right until the moment his installation touched ground, he worried that someone might suddenly pull the plug. After all, a certain degree of uncertainty was always to be expected at an event with no historical precedent in the Antarctic. For curator Nadim Saman, that slightly chaotic atmosphere was just part of the show.
We're not sure whether or not we're a workshop, a studio, and a sort of a live simulation, or whether we're an exhibition. You know, the boundaries between production and display are kind of all mixed up. We say that we're a biennale in process. We take the motto from Captain Nemo, mobilis in mobile, movement amidst movement. We are a very dynamic event in an improvisational way. We're trying to achieve our goals, but we're also making it all up as we go along. And that's very new, I think, for a biennale.
Now that the artists are back on dry land, their works will be presented at the Antarctic Pavilion in Venice in May, before touring international museums. The Biennale team is also thinking about the expedition's legacy, plotting how to form a permanent institution that continues flying the flag of Antarctic art and culture. For Monocle, in Antarctica, I'm Frederick Bernas.
Thanks to Frederick Bernas for that report. Now, to end the programme, as always, we're joined in the studio by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Hello, Fernando.
Hello, Tom.
For this week's Global Countdown, Faye, where are we heading this week?
We are heading to Nigeria, Tom. And do you know why? Because, you know, even though I don't think they are the biggest music market in Africa, I believe it's still South Africa, but they are the most influential, at least in my opinion. Because if you look at the charts, you know, artists like Drake, Rihanna, Beyoncé, they actually use a lot of, they're inspired by the Afrobeat from Nigeria, which is quite up-tempo, a fusion of some Nigerian rhythms with, you know, jazz and soul as well. And they even some of their local artists are actually, you know, very popular in the US, even here in the United Kingdom, like Wizkid. I mean, he's on the chart, which I'm going to do a little countdown here for you.
Well, let me ask you about the chart, because we've been talking a bit about the dominance of different charts around the world, often by one artist, whether it's your sort of Ed Sheeran's here or Drake stateside. Is it a bit of a mixed bag, though, in Nigeria, or is it the same problem where it's dominated by, I don't know, one artist or one group?
It's very mixed. There's no repetition here in the top five, even though the beat is quite similar. You know, I can't say that, you know, one is folk and the other is electronic music. It's all the top five songs have this kind of specific beat, the Afrobeat, which you see, you know, in the US charts as well. So, yeah, different artists, but same rhythm.
Okay, well, I'm going to learn more. Mark and Kathy, are you experts, or are we going to be learning together about the subtleties of the Nigerian charts
today?
I'm
as good on Nigerian music as you were on Gravity, Tom.
Okay, that is worrying. Well, you've got to start somewhere. We've got a foundation that's ready for building. Faye, take it away. Where should we start? What's in the top five are we looking at?
I'll do a countdown, but then I have something fun to say about number one. But number five, we have Nigerian singer from Lagos. I believe he's the only one from Lagos, which is Nigeria's largest city. Korede Bello, and his song is called Korede. I did some research, but I couldn't find. I think it was a tribute to himself, perhaps.
Oh, how modest of him.
It is a great track, though. Number four, that's the interesting artist, which is Wizkid. I mean, he is from Nigeria. And this song is, he did a partnership with Drake.
He does get everywhere, Drake.
He does get everywhere. But I have to remind you, you know, Wizkid was in Drake's song One Dance, which was, I believe, the number one song last year, one of the most popular tracks. And this is a brand new track called Come Closer, which is, you know, quite a cool track as well. And as I said, Wizkid, very popular in Nigeria. Number three, we have Runtown with Mad Over You. And Runtown again, same Afrobeat. But I have to tell you guys, if you have time, do check out their videos. They look quite expensive, actually. You know, something, you know, that people might not, you know, think. But it's very high budget. You know, I was a bit impressed. So I did like the video from Mad Over You.
Okay, we'll check that one out. What about Towards the Top of the Tree? What do we find?
Number two, we have Nigerian artists. Again, they're all very young. The artist is called Techno, not a rhythm. He's just Techno. And the song's called Yawa. Again, another great track. But I believe we have a snippet of the number one song, and let's see what you guys think.
Fernando, what were we hearing? What's top of the parade?
That's Davido with the song called If. And the interesting thing about Davido, I mean, he is Nigerian, but he was born in America. He was born in Atlanta from Nigerian parents, but he moved back to Nigeria when he was very young. But it's interesting because his label, Sony, is trying to, you know, launch him in the US as well. I was reading some blogs that people were worried that he was changing his style to appeal to Americans. But I think everyone agrees that If was quite a good catchy song, and that's why it's number one. But the surprise thing here, currently Nigeria is watching the Big Brother. They have their own version. And I can tell you, breaking news, that Davido was in the Big Brother house yesterday.
Wow.
And he did a little performance.
I liked him until that. I lost a bit of credibility. No?
And apparently they were talking about, you know, because I think it was $1 million you get if you get the Big Brother. And apparently said that he spent that in a month.
Oh,
I didn't like
another
honest
character. Yeah. What do we think, Tim? I know you're a fan, or potentially a fan, of the Nigerian brewed Guinness. Though other stouts are available. If you were enjoying one of those, would you listen to any of the five?
Well,
entrants?
I would.
What about Davido? Sounds good.
I'm always intrigued by he keeps mentioning the word Nigerian beat or the African beat. Is that I'm starting to learn a bit of drums at the moment, and it's one of those disciplines that you think is. We've all watched a drummer, and we can all go 1, 2, 3, 4. We can do that with our hands on our knees. But it's incredibly difficult, and I'm really impressed by African drummers because they really make it look simple, and they've got some of the most complicated beats. I've been trying to remember, and sorry to be like the old fart in the corner here, going back to the 1960s. Wasn't it Nigeria that Ginger Baker from Cream went to? You know, the drummer in Cream, who went out to Africa and set up a farm because he was fascinated by the drumming there. I'm not sure if it was an idea. It was definitely Africa. But yeah, I'd be intrigued by the drumming side of it.
Indeed. So. Kathy, are we convinced you? You look unsure, yeah?
Well, I don't know anything about music, do I? So
to be fair, you didn't
mention it. I say, my opinion matters. But no, I found it very interesting. Thanks for having me along. You know, it's very enjoyable.
it became a little party here at the end. Lovely stuff. Well, thanks to one and all. Fernando, thanks for counting down those tracks. Mark Mason, Kathy Rensenbrink, thanks for being with us. As ever, the programme was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando. Double thanks to him then. And do join us at the same time again next week. But for now, let's play the rest of that number one track from Davido. This is If. My number one is tutu. Sipping brook tutu. For your love is tutu. I go tuku tuku tuku. Biko obianuju. Say you do me juju. Cause I'm feeling the juju. Shake it to you. I wanna dash it to you. Take it. You can have it to you. Take it. You know I got this in you. Take it.